Greetings, and welcome to First Impressions, a production of Marginalia Radio. I'm your host, Dave Kruger. Joining us is Stephen K. Green, who is the Fred H. Paulus Professor of Law, Affiliated Professor of History, and the Director of the Center for Religion, Law, and Democracy at Willamette University in Oregon. Stephen is the author of Inventing a Christian America, The Myth of the Religious Founding, published by Oxford University Press in 2015. Stephen, welcome to Marginalia Radio.
Thanks, Dave.
In your book, you argue that there is a pervasive and enduring theme in U.S. history that religion played a pivotal role in the nation's origins. Could you describe the content of this narrative and give our listeners some sense of how powerful it is in American culture?
Certainly. Actually, the narrative has two parts to it, and I discuss both parts in the book. The first part is the idea that America was settled by people in search of religious freedom, fleeing religious persecution in Europe, coming to the shores of what was North America, and setting up colonies or settlements in order to advance the cause of religious freedom. And in turn, offered religious toleration, if not religious equality, to other religious dissenters who came over. So that's the first part of the narrative. And we have a long-standing tradition of religious liberty in America, and that was at the center of the settlement of the British colonies. The second related narrative, which is the bulk of the book's coverage, deals with a more specific claim that the founding principles of our nation in the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the political principles of republicanism have some type of religious basis, some type of religious origins, and is traced back chiefly to the Puritan time period, and that the Puritans were the kind of the earliest establishers of republican government in America, and that the founders relied on kind of religious principles when they were establishing the new nation.
Could you describe for our listeners what you mean by the term myth when you speak of this narrative or these narratives about the beginning of the United States?
In the book, I try to be very clear that I'm using the term myth more in an anthropological sense, even though you can never escape from kind of the more popular ways of thinking about a myth as some type of unfounded fable. Here, I use the term myth to mean that in the early part of the 19th century, that this idea of America's religious founding, and particularly of its Christian founding being part of the political principles of the government, was created by the second generation of Americans, and it became our national identity myth, that in essence all nations have some type of myth of origins. And this is one of the most powerful myth of origins that we have about the United States. And it developed primarily because the people of the second generation, who did not have firsthand knowledge of exactly the founding period, one thing they wanted to do, and here we're talking about the early 1800s, is to distinguish American republicanism from the radical French republicanism that had basically imploded in the French Revolution, and to exemplify America. They wanted to be able to explain how the United States was actually going to survive, and how the United States had been able to defeat the most powerful nation on earth. And the explanations that they sought had to have some type of indication of God's presence in them. That in essence, the only rational, to a certain extent, explanation for this was God had specially blessed America, that the founders had relied on religious principles in the creation of our institutions, and that it constructed this myth of origins of the United States. And it's a very strong myth, became very pervasive, and I argue that this became kind of the foundational myth for our belief that America is specially blessed, that God has been on our side, and that some people take the myth even further, and they basically pick up on the argument that the founding principles are in fact Christian principles, that we are a Christian nation, not just demographically, but that we are a nation that has a special relationship with God, such that our political institutions and the way we interpret the Constitution has to be consistent with this tradition.
As you already mentioned, one claim within the Christian nation myth is that the U.S. was founded as a haven for religious liberty. But you show that history is a lot more complicated than that. How so?
Well, I think most people recognize or at least know the stories of the Puritans and the idea that the Puritans were somewhat intolerant people. But many times we see that as the only example of religious intolerance during the founding period. That's hardly the case. And what I argue in the book is that the principles of religious liberty that we find in the First Amendment to the Constitution did not come naturally, did not come by default. they were not really, to a certain extent, based upon the previous almost 200-year tradition within the United States, within the British colonies. All of the colonies were intolerant. All of the colonies, with the possible exception of Pennsylvania, persecuted dissenters to a certain extent. That was the tradition during this period of time. And so we need to not glorify this period of founding that the Puritans or others came in search of religious freedom in the sense of expanding that and creating a regime of religious freedom. It was actually quite the opposite. People wanted the ability to believe in themselves, but they really could care less about extending that to other people. It was only through the necessity of unifying the various colonies to take religion off the table as a very divisive idea that the founders came up with some of these principles about no religious test for public office holding, which is a quite significant event. But those were very modern events at that particular period of time. The main tradition throughout the colonial period was one of religious intolerance, not religious freedom.
Other scholars who have written about the Christian nation rhetoric in U.S. history have emphasized its widespread deployment starting in the 1950s or even the 1930s. However, you argue that appeals to the nation's religious founding began much earlier. So how early are we talking about?
Well, to a degree, this narrative actually goes back before the founding. The Puritans, certainly, not just the Puritans, actually up and down the eastern seaboard, the various settlers of the various colonies, they all claimed God's special blessing. They all claimed some special relationship with God. Now, the Puritans were at the forefront of this. The iconic statement of being a city on the hill, the exemplar to all the world, that they had established a covenant with God. And so this idea of some type of covenantal relationship with God goes back into the Puritan period. So it has very old provenance. But generally speaking, this more specific idea of America being a Christian nation, of course, has to come after the nation is founded. And what I argue is that there's several things that kind of came together at the beginning of the 19th century. One was what I've already discussed, that the second generation wanted to try to construct some way of sanctifying the nation, making it different, exemplifying the nation. That coincided with what's called the Second Great Awakening, which was the religious revivals of the early part of the 19th century, where the American landscape was just transformed and evangelicalism became the dominant form of Protestant expression. And as part of that was this idea that America would be a place of the second coming of Jesus Christ, where the millennium would take place. And in that sense, we needed to have a perfected country in order to be that place where this millennium would occur. The other element that kind of came into place was that I mentioned in the book, the New England intelligentsia of the early part of the 19th century. That is a way of maintaining their relevance to a certain extent, or New England's relevance, as the nation was expanding. They went back and looked at some of the Puritan arguments that had been made in the 150 years ago, and they resurrected these. And they wrote narratives and histories and gave orations that once again claimed that the Puritans and the Pilgrims were the progenitors of American republicanism. And so all of these kind of came together in the first third of the 19th century. And it was incorporated into school books. It became, again, this kind of pervasive narrative of America's special relationship with God and of our origins. And so that, in my mind, is where this comes into being. Now, this narrative has ebbed and flowed over history. Kevin Cruz's new book, One Nation Under God, which is a fascinating book about how the corporate America kind of resurrected this in the 1930s. And it came, once again, to popularity in the 1950s with the religious revival during that period of time, you know, in juxtaposition to the Cold War. There are different times that this has come into being. The more recent resurrection of this idea has really been kind of in the post-Reagan era, where people, again, wanted to exemplify America. And it's become extremely popular today, both by popular historians who kind of peddle this idea of America being a Christian nation, and in a less specific sense, kind of a more general sense, by politicians all the time who talk about America being specially blessed. And there is just, I think, pervasive within the American culture. One of the ironies in some of the polls that are taken, approximately 55 to 60% of Americans claim they believe in separation of church and state. And almost exactly the same number of people claim that the U.S. Constitution creates a Christian nation. And so it's a pervasive narrative that exists in our society.
In what way has the Christian nation myth been used to marginalize minorities within American culture?
Yeah, the myth of America's Christian origins, for most people, is very benign, but it has been used to be very exclusive. It was clearly used in the early part of the 19th century because this myth, even though it's Christian, it clearly meant Protestant, it meant Calvinist. It was meant as a way of excluding Catholics and marginalizing Catholics who were coming over in beginning in the 1830s, 1840s. It was used as a way of marginalizing Jews later on. It has, in some respects, been a way of marginalizing people of other religious faiths, Muslims today. But in essence, it says that our principles are directly derived from Christian principles. And so Christianity has to be at least the first among equals, if not kind of the dominant religious tradition within the United States from where we derive our values. And so we see this played out all the time with controversies over Ten Commandment monuments in courthouses or in public areas, or under God in the Pledge of Allegiance or on our currency. People go to the mat to defend these things because to them, this is at the core of what America's identity is about. And for people of other faiths, this can be extremely alienating and it can create tribalism. And so it has had a kind of a pernicious side to it. That is why it is, has been relatively dangerous. When I was doing my dissertation work 20-some-odd years ago, I looked at as many 19th century church state cases as I could find. There are a host of cases from the 19th century dealing with blasphemy, Sabbath law enforcement, religious requirements to take oaths, where judges use the concept of America being a Christian nation as a way of excluding Catholics, Jews, atheists, universalists from being able to be full participants in our public life. So it has had a real negative impact on our history and times.
Proponents of the Christian nation myth and their opponents are often preoccupied with proving that revolutionary leaders and constitutional writers were either Orthodox Protestants or hardcore deists. What are both sides missing?
Well, both sides to this debate, although I do take sides in this debate to a certain extent, that I believe we have had a secular founding instead of a religious founding. But both sides of this debate have often fallen back on not a very good historical technique, what is called proof texting. Is they go back and they scour the historical record, and they look to see try to find statements in letters, speeches, etc., that substantiate their predispositions about America's foundings. And you can find almost anything in the historical record, as I've often said. I mean, anyone may have said anything about at any time in their life. Just depends on what was written down and preserved. So there are ample statements out there by people like George Washington, John Adams, talking about God's providence. And then there are counter statements, in a sense, by people like Thomas Jefferson and James Madison that talk about separation of church and state. What I try to do in this book is to step back from this debate and try to understand the greater context of the use of rhetoric. And I'm not a rhetorician, but to understand why this religious rhetoric existed during the founding period. And one of the things we have to, of course, keep in mind is that religion is one of the most powerful tools for motivating people. And certainly you find throughout the Revolutionary War period in all the sermons, and there are hundreds of sermons that have been preserved, and in speeches, that a common technique was, of course, to demonize Great Britain, to compare them to Great Britain to Egypt and king to Pharaoh, and resurrect the Exodus narrative as a way of trying to explain America and the battle. And this was done for the purpose, of course, of trying to justify and legitimize the revolution, but to a certain extent also, I think, to kind of shore up wavering patriots. We have to remember George Washington lost a whole lot more battles than he won. And there were many times when it looked like the Revolutionary War would have gone the other direction. One-third of the colonialists remained loyalists. And so there were a lot of people who were wavering in this cause. And one of the more compelling ways of convincing people is to employ religious rhetoric, which isn't surprising because religious rhetoric was very pervasive during the founding period. I mean, the Bible was the most common book available, and that's where the stories and the narratives and the metaphors would have been that people would have identified with. And so this exists out here. So I guess what I'm trying to do in this book to a certain extent is to say to people, look at the context. Try to understand why certain rhetoric was used and how it was being used. And don't take that rhetoric at face value. Christian nationalists, the ones who are pro-Christianization, do this so much more than secular scholars do. But some secular scholars do this too. I mean, they like to make the claim that the founders were deists. I don't think that's true. I call most of them rational theists, and what I mean by that is that they tried to integrate Enlightenment rationalism into their Christian beliefs, and most of them were quite progressive for the time, but I don't think they rejected Christianity outright. I think Ben Franklin was the only one who ever claimed to be a deist. So we need to see things in shades of gray instead of black and white.
Finally, what would you like your readers to take away from this book?
Well, I would like for them to take away John Faith, who's written a book about this, and I quote him in conclusion. He makes a kind of pithy little statement that history is complex, and it is. History is not cut and dried. It is not simple. And so we need to understand that political players at the time were using certain terminology and rhetoric for political reasons. I mean, we today seem to be skeptical of any type of statement of a politician. But when it comes to historical statements by historical figures, we seem to take those at face value. And so we need to appreciate both the context within which they were speaking, as well as the possible reasons they may have used a certain type of rhetoric. And once again, like I say, religious rhetoric was very pervasive during the founding period. But let's not take it at face value. We need to approach the historical record with skepticism, like we approach the contemporary rhetoric that we hear from politicians.
With that, we conclude this episode of First Impressions. Again, the book is Inventing a Christian America, The Myth of the Religious Founding. Thanks to Stephen Green for joining us, and thanks to all of our listeners for tuning in. Have a great day.